Nick.
I have everything in all my closet. Okay, good evening, everyone. This is a public hearing of the City Council on our budget. Today is Wednesday, March 9th, and it is 5 o'clock. Roll call, please.
Mayor Reese.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Gonzalez G.
Here.
Councilmember Higginbotham.
Here.
Councilmember Natoli.
Aye.
And for the record, Councilmember Rabinalt is absent.
Okay, as I said, this is a public hearing, but is there anyone in the public that wants to address us prior to the public hearing? It would have to be on the items on the agenda.
Yes.
Please.
I'd just like to comment, of course, Dinosaur Cave Park's coming along so nicely, but on Planning Division number 3 under Civic Center Strategic Plan, I just like to deeply endorse that because that would probably include the looking at the Bella Street Auditorium, which plot, and speaking for Pacific Light Opera, Abysmal Pacific Light Opera Theater, is very interested in getting back to what was formerly our home. And that was that looks like it's going to be a good start if the Planning Commission is able to get a good start on finding out how much it'll cost to refit and retool and hopefully to have a civic center there. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak to one of the items on the agenda?
Paul Salko, 871 Merced Street, Pismo Beach. I just got here. I'm not sure whether this is on the agenda or not. If it isn't, then I will cease and desist.
Okay.
After the aftermath of last week's meeting regarding Boussinger Park, is there anything in the budget here to address in solving some of the general plan commitments for spending of money to do certain things, such as acquiring the Boussinger Park outcroppings, undergrounding of utilities, which is in the general plan? So I was wondering whether there's any funds being set aside or plans to set aside in the current budget plan or in the future. So if this isn't appropriate, we'll address it at another time.
Okay. In terms of purchase of the outcroppings, that's not something that would be on the agenda?
But what I'm saying is it in the budget to put in to implement some of the things that are in the general plan, such as I gave those two examples?
Madam Mayor and Council, if I could, maybe I could ask Randy Bloom to go ahead and try and answer that.
As far as the general plan policies, we have in our work program to do a review and update of the general plan. Now, that is a policy review and potential change in some of the policies, but there's not physical CIP capital improvement monies in the budget
for
any of those items.
Well, I thank you for that explanation. I just urge you to start considering something like that, to start building a kitty so that we can start implementing and developing a plan to do these kinds of things in the future. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'd like to add some information to that if you'd like.
Okay.
The general plan lists priorities for undergrounding using public funds for undergrounding. The source of the public funds are PG&E set-aside monies, and I don't remember the exact figure. I think PG&E has on paper set aside about $600,000 for undergrounding on major thoroughfares in Pismo Beach. The list of priorities in the general plan under the design element design element of the general plan includes Price Street, Shell Beach Road, the downtown, streets that intersect those main thoroughfares, and then the last item on the priority is undergrounding of backyard easements. So what it would take to spring loose those monies would be to get together with PG&E and get a program started. But as far as general fund monies for to supplement that, there, Randy's statement is accurate in terms of there being no general fund money set aside for that purpose.
Okay. Thank you for that information. Okay. We're ready to begin. And the first item, Mr. City Manager.
Yes, Madam Mayor and Council. We'll
that, for the 8 months through February, through the end of February 2005, that whereas the budget revenues for the entire year were $11,560,000, we had expended in those, we'd received in those 8 months $6.9 million, which amounts to 60% of the annual budget. In that, some revenues are pretty slow in coming. Some are unusually fast in coming. For example, we typically get all of our business tax revenues. It's the fourth line down. Fifth line down early in the year, in the fiscal year. Those are due in the fall, and actually in the late summer. And then, on the other hand, the transient occupancy tax here is just the. Shows the taxes which have been received or accounted for in January at the hotels, if you will, and received in February. But that really is only 7 months worth of TOT. So and there are others. So and then there are some places where we've not accounted for interest in here, which is part of the use of money and property, and some of the intergovernment revenues we'll expect to come in the future. But basically, it appears to be on track with our expectations as of this time on the revenue side.
Okay.
Any questions on the revenue?
I'll ask the council. Does anyone have any questions on that?
Then
I have none this time.
Okay. Then on the expenditure side, the bottom half of the chart, again here we show the various accounts by the departments, if you will, and overall we're showing it at 55% of expenditures. That includes both street construction and CIP, of which there's been none recorded yet. This is general fund CIP, and if we looked at just the operating costs of all these departments, that would come out to about 59%, which is essentially the same as the 60% on revenues for the year. We do show expenditures anticipated, including the CIP and street construction. There are other projects actually within some of these funds of about $13.9 million. And at the end of the year, we'd anticipate having a balance, if that's the case, of about $1.1
million. So it would appear that we have not spent any money on the CIP at all. Is that what this is saying?
Of those which are projects which are listed under the general fund CIP, yes.
None have been expended?
That's correct.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't know. I had a chance to talk this over with Mr. Delzite to see if there were factors in that or if there are things that are underway. Certainly there are capital improvement projects such as the wastewater treatment plant, but that's in the wastewater enterprise fund, and there are things I think going on in the water fund as well. But I'm not aware that we have reported and recorded anything in the general fund CIP.
Do you have any comment?
I'd have to look at those projects. This is the first time I've seen that figure, because I know we're doing a lot of things. That figure surprises me, so I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
One.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay, is any the rest of the council?
Hi.
If I could, too, I know for you, I spent the day reading through the staff reports for this coming Tuesday's council meeting, 6 days from now, and there is one of the agenda items in there is for general fund expenditures for road slurries and seals, overlays, So you will see that in about 6 days coming to you for a decision.
Okay. Thank you.
One question on the lifeguards. We don't currently have lifeguards on the beach, do we, on weekends? Isn't that program?
We do not. That's correct. Now, some of our firemen, and I'd have to ask Chief Turner, he's in the background there. We do have some firemen that are also lifeguard trained. I want to say three or four. Chief, can you help us out there?
The answer to your question is correct. We do not have lifeguard stationed either on the weekends nor during the daytime this time of year. It's typically from Memorial Day through Labor Day, mm-hmm. a little bit of flex on either side of that depending upon weather. But many of our firefighters are trained lifeguards. In fact, they're conducting a water rescue as we speak, just north of the pier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess
in the budget process seemed to be something that would be good to bring forward again. For you to have a chance to see and see if there's some direction you'd like to.
Okay, before we do that, I'm just going to open this up to the public to see if they want to make any comments on item one, and then we'll go on to Mr. Statler. Is there anyone in the public that would like to comment on item one?
The chamber is in the audience tonight with a lot of its data that you might not be aware that we have that we're tracking. We've been tracking sales tax for about 10 years now. I have a question on the top part on the projected revenue for the sales tax. Fiscal ending in 205, it shows a little over $2 million. Interesting, in the forecast, the general fund five-year forecast, it showed the same estimate at $1.9 million. So we've grown $100,000 there. Then also in the estimate, it showed that we had the sales tax estimate for fiscal ending 2004 at $1.8 million, and yet our sales tax block report by Heinleiter and DeLamas and Associates shows it at $1.6 million. So there's quite a bit of difference in the numbers. Why this is important? If we, in the past, what's got us to this point is we've conservatively estimated revenues, and then the revenue surprises us and gives us more money, hence the unallocated funds things that we all counted on the last couple of years. I really have a problem with the estimates and sales tax at this point being over $2 million. I think, and if you look at that, and I don't know, George, you could probably say why it's only 48% of that reporting right now in the first 7 months, but for us to get $2 million in sales tax, some anomaly would have to happen with a shopping center open up or something like that. Double-digit gains in sales tax is really tough, and if you go with the $2 million over what we had for and fiscal ending in 2004 by Heinleiter, it's like a 21% increase. It ain't going to happen. So that I'm just questioning some of these numbers. I really worry that we get the bad estimates, and then we budget up to those estimates. The estimates don't come in, and all of a sudden we're into our reserves. So that's just the question there.
Okay. George, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. On that, and our sales tax that we reported last year were $1,867,000. Which would require, about a pretty close to a 10% increase, I think, in sales tax for this year. On the other hand, our property taxes, and by the way, that sales tax was a bit lower than had been budgeted for last year. On the other hand, property taxes came in at $1,980,000. Which would require barely less than a 5% increase, and that's been growing pretty vigorously over the past several years. And in truth, when we did our mid-cycle budget review in August, and we and staff noted that it looked like the sales tax would come under what had been budgeted for fiscal 05. On the other hand, that property tax would come in higher, and the combination of the two, it looked like, would come right in on what the total sum would be. And rather than make a mid-budget change in that, we left those alone as they were. So And maybe we should have made that adjustment at the time, but Mr. Churton's comment is correct. I think that we probably will not meet that sales tax unless there's a lot more activity than we're expecting. On the other hand, with property tax in at 86% of what we had budgeted, chances are we'll exceed the property tax, and the combination of the two should come out to the total sum of $4,060,000.
Right, but his point is well taken.
I think
we've really always tried to be very conservative and then be pleasantly surprised. So, okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
Surely.
Okay, is there any other questions regarding item one from the audience? Seeing none, then City Manager, you want to go to item two?
Yes, Madam Mayor. Item two is actually Mr. Bill Statler is going to give us an abbreviated version of the revenue options briefing he gave us back at the mid-cycle budget briefing back in June or July. And this was a request of the council to come back with this, and in particular, Councilmember Rabinal had requested that we bring this thing back and then also look at some timelines if the council wanted to do anything with this briefing. So we'll also talk a little bit about timelines. Bill?
Good evening. As Kevin indicated, the purpose is to kind of give you a little bit of a week and indicate you could fund your existing infrastructure plus some level of new initiatives. And, of course, if it was negative, then that would be the budget gap that you would have. There was some good news in the findings. While there are fiscal challenges ahead for the city, you're in good shape to position them. Your ongoing revenues do exceed your basic operating costs and your debt service costs. You have a carryover from end of 2004-05 that looks like that would be about $300,000 above your minimum policy level. Strong reserves that are meeting your 15% policy level. And certainly compared to the past, the forecast would be assuming a much higher level of infrastructure maintenance than you've in fact historically done. And that would give you some flexibility if you did reach some different, more difficult times ahead that you could take a look at your capital improvement program before reducing your basic day-to-day services. The not-so-good news is there is no order of magnitude ability to fund new initiatives, and in fact, the city would be looking at a significant gap in the future if you maintain current service levels and adequately maintain the infrastructure you already have in place. And the way a couple of caveats about this is we talk about the gap that would be in front of you after 2004-05. Forecast is not a budget. It doesn't make revenue decisions. It doesn't make expenditure decisions. It doesn't set priorities. And in fact, you know, a question that finance folks like George and I are often asked is, can we afford X? And that's almost always the wrong question. The question is, what do you want to do and why? Because you have the ability to fund any one thing. You can probably afford any one or two things. What you don't have the capacity to do, and no city in California has, you don't have the ability to do everything. And at some point, you have to make priority decisions about what you can and can't do. And that's not really the purpose of the forecast, to try and assess what your priorities ought to be, as much as identify those factors that affect your fiscal outlook and really assess how difficult is budget balancing going to be in the future. Obviously, the forecast is based on events that haven't happened yet. The only way we could put together the forecast is try and put together what we think are revenue assumptions about what operating costs are likely to be, what revenues are likely to be, what are the costs of maintaining your existing access assets, and more importantly, what are the factors that affect all of those things going in into the future. And I'm not going to read some because we don't have enough time, and I'm not sure people would be that interested in what all of those are, but let's cut to the chase. What the forecast showed is if all we were trying to do was cover your operating and debt service costs, that would generate about $600,000 a year starting in 2006-07. That would be available for capital projects, whether that's new capital projects, whether that's maintaining what you already have. You clearly have the capacity to at least meet your day-to-day expenditures and pay back to the bondholders funds that you borrowed. But once you introduce capital into that, if all you were to do is adequately maintain the infrastructure you already have, not new things, and I'll talk about what those might be in Pismo Beach in a minute, but if you just adequately maintain what you already have in place, then you'd be looking at a gap in those out years of more like $500,000 a year, and obviously that wouldn't give you the capacity to do new things like a new fire station, like new traffic signals, significantly upgrading your city streets, thinking about downtown parking, doing storm drain improvements. Those are not the kind of things that are in that forecast. Filling chuck holes, taking care of the paving that you already have, that's reflected in that maintenance number. But to the degree that you'd want to do some significant new projects, that's not reflected in that number at all. So long story short, you're not facing problems in just meeting basic payroll and covering your day-to-day costs. You should have adequate revenues to cover that. But if you want to do more than that, if you want to adequately maintain the infrastructure you have now, let alone take on new initiatives, you are going to need some additional revenues in order to do that. And that's really the purpose of the revenue option study, is given that you might like to do more than just meet the payroll every other week, what would be involved in gaining extra revenues to do the types of projects and improvements that the city might like to do. So twofold purpose: one, identify what those new revenue sources would be, and then discuss what would be required under Proposition 218 to implement those. Just some context as you think about revenue options in the future is to take a look at where your key revenues are coming from now. And what this really shows is about three of your key revenue sources are about 75% of your total general fund budget. Transit oxy tax revenues are 40% of your revenues. Property tax is 17%. Sales tax is about 17%, 16%. And after that, you drop off to revenue sources that are a very small slice of the pie. So really, your top three revenue sources, almost 75% of your total revenues. This tells me really two things. One, if we increase any one of those three, that will have a significant increase in your overall revenue sources. On the other hand, you're highly dependent on these three revenue sources. And as you think about other revenue sources, one of the many things you might want to consider is how do you kind of diversify that egg basket in the event that any one of these three things wants to go south. I would probably argue that the advantage of those three particular items is there are probabilities, or from other cities in California, if you did it, probably importantly, would voter approval or council approval be required? Are there any restrictions on how the revenues could be used? How would you collect the money? Might be a really great revenue idea out there, but you might spend as much money trying to collect it as the revenue is worth. So you might want to think about how this would be collected. Again, one of those issues that I discussed before is how would the revenue affect the diversity and stability of the city's revenue base? If you were interested in pursuing the revenue, how quickly or how soon could it be implemented? And are there any special implementation issues associated with the revenue source? So we answered these questions in some detail for each of them, and I'm not going to go into this much detail on all of them, but I will give you kind of a broad overview of the results. There are obviously pros and cons associated with each of these revenue items. Most of them require voter approval, and here are kind of the two key things to keep in mind. If it's for a general purpose, we just want to generally improve streets, parks, police, fire, that would be a general purpose revenue item, and that could be approved with a majority vote of the voters. Typically, that would need to come forward at a regular municipal election, so that would be in November of even-numbered years. However, there is a provision for special elections if the council was to unanimously agree upon a general revenue measure upon declaring a fiscal emergency, then you could hold that at any time. But typically, a general-purpose election would be held in conjunction with your general municipal election. And although you could explain to voters that we need it to fill check holes, arrest bad guys, put out fires, and mow parks, you couldn't guarantee and you couldn't earmark it for a specific purpose. Because as soon as you said, we will use it for street maintenance and for police and for fire, that's going to become a special purpose tax measure, and that's going to require two-thirds voter approval. Obviously, the difference here is majority voter approval is trust us to spend the money wisely. And that's a lower level of threshold for voter approval. If soon as you earmark it, which makes it easier to communicate to people how you're going to use it, but then the threshold for gaining voter support goes up. And that election could be held at any time. One of the advantages of holding it, however, in conjunction with some type of statewide election is obviously the election costs will be much less if you consolidate with some other election than if you, in fact, have a special election and pay for that on your own. So we'll kind of hit the key revenue items and some key overview information about it. Transit oxy tax, your current rate is 10%. That is really pretty much the overwhelming rate throughout the state of California. But those cities that do have higher rates are tourist-based cities like Anaheim, like San Francisco. like like San Francisco, like Anaheim. And the highest rate, that goes up to about 15%, is the highest rate in the state. For those cities that do have a higher rate, 12% is the most common higher rate than 10% throughout the state. In the case of Pismo Beach, for every 1% rate from that 10%, that would generate about $470,000. So, for example, if you went to a 12% rate, you would generate almost $1 million a year in added revenue. Again, the approval requirements for this, if it's for a general purpose, that would be majority vote approval. If you were to earmark it, we're going to use this to improve our paving throughout the community, that would be a two-thirds vote. Local option sales tax. About a year ago, legislation was adopted that allows cities to have a local option sales tax above and beyond the base rate that is in place. Today, the current effective rate for the city of Pismo Beach is 1%. I won't go into a lot of detail on this, but because of very complicated triple flip, actually technically your sales tax rate is 0.75%, but the state has promised to backfill that other quarter, so the effective sales tax rate is 1%. And with Proposition 1A, that backfill of a quarter is constitutionally protected, so I think there's a high likelihood that as the year goes by, all of the cities in California will in fact have an effective 1% rate. There are some cash flow implications because of how that happens, but essentially the effective rate is 1%. So what that means is if you were to have a local option sales tax and if you set that at 0.25%, almost about $500,000 a year in added revenues to the city, and at 0.5%, very close to $1 million. Again, the approval requirements are just the same as it would be for TOT, majority voter approval if it's for a general purpose, two-thirds voter approval if it was for a special purpose. Parcel taxes, these are allowed under the Constitution as long as they're not based on value, as long as they're a flat rate. In Pismo Beach's case, you do have parcel taxes in place now. You have them to pay for state water, and you have them to pay for the Lopez Dam seismic retrofitting. So it was actually pretty easy to identify what additional revenues that would be generated. Each equivalent dwelling unit, and that's basically a single-family residence, for each $100 a year that you were to assess, that would raise about $700,000. This requires two-thirds voter approval, however, whether it's for a general or a special purpose. That's just the state law. Parcel taxes require two-thirds voter approval regardless of the reason. The reason is typically it was adopted when they adopted it at whatever the sales tax rate was at the time. So if that was a benchmark measure for this, it would be about $600,000. Again, majority voter approval if for general purpose, two-thirds voter approval if earmarked. And again, this is not a tax that you have in place today.
Excuse me, Mr. Statler. How do you levy that?
You would need voter approval to do it, but basically by having the voters approve an ordinance setting utility users tax at whatever rate they agreed to do, and then the utility companies would collect that on your behalf and would remit that to you monthly. Is that a short enough answer? Okay. Shouldn't probably have asked it short enough if it was long enough. Business license tax. In short, every 10% increase in your current rates would generate about $12,000 a year. This is probably not what I would refer to as the proverbial low-hanging fruit. It's probably not a significant revenue raiser for you, but it's certainly an option. But again, you know, if you increase the rate by 10%, you would generate the big $12,000 a year, but you would need voter approval to do that. Majority voter approval for general purpose, two-thirds if it was earmarked. If you had a particular capital project that you wanted to fund, for example, you wanted to take care of every street in town and give it a really good overlay that'll give it a nice 50-year life, and you wanted to issue general obligation bonds to do that, you can. General obligation bonds can obviously only be issued for capital projects, and it is the only allowable increase above that 1% general purpose levy allowed under Proposition 13 is for general obligation bonds. And again, you're one of the few cities in the state of California that has done this for the Lopez Dam project. Basically, your debt capacity, and I'm not suggesting that you would do this, but under the general laws of California, you could issue up to $55 million worth of bonds for improvements and be within your debt ceiling. That would be a pretty high property tax rate to do that, but that's what you would be legally allowed to do. And again, this would specifically require two-thirds voter approval to do. Revenue cost specialists back in 2002 did an analysis of both user fees and assessment district potential. They identified the possibility of $168,000 in additional revenues if you were to form a citywide maintenance district for street lighting and sweeping. It's a little bit different. This can be done with majority voter approval, but it's done based on who has the assessments, and your vote is weighted by how big your assessment is. So if one house had an assessment of $100 and another house had an assessment of $50, the person with a $100 assessment would have twice as many votes as the person with a $50 assessment. Typically, single-family residences would be the same. Where you get that weighting is in the non-residential uses, but it also means if I was a property owner and I owned three single-family residences, I would have three votes because it would be based on how the assessment is weighted, and only those people with assessments would vote. So if you were, for example, a renter, you would not be the person that would vote on this issue. It would be the property owners. But in that case, it still would be a 50% voter approval from those people who are eligible to vote of those people who turned out and voted. So if you had folks who might be supportive, but they didn't come out to vote, you're going to base it on who did come out to vote. Very complicated process for determining and proving assessments. I'd be happy to go into more detail if this looks like something you wanted to pursue. But this is a relatively complicated and complex undertaking, and the voter approval requirement is a little bit different than how we typically think of voters. In this case, the voters are who are being assessed for the fee, and it would be weighted by the amount of their assessment. Property transfer tax, this is a tax that would be in place when property changes hands. Typically would be the seller's responsibility to pay. Right now you have this rate in effect at the level of 5.5 cents per $1,000 of value. You share that with the county, it gets the other 5.5 cents. If in an unincorporated area, the whole $1.10 would go to the county. In incorporated areas, it's split 50-50 with them. For those cities that have adopted their own real property transfer tax, $4.40 is probably the most common rate, but you could set it at whatever rate you wanted to. In your case, if you set it at $4.40 per thousand, that would generate a net $600,000 a year. In a community like Pismo Beach, where property values are going up significantly, people capture that equity when they sell their homes. An argument made for this is an appropriate source of revenue, because one of the reasons why people's values have gone up is, in fact, the types of levels of service that a city like Pismo Beach provides adds value to people's homes, and this is a way for sharing that at a time when they have that funding, when they sell the home and gain the capital gains from that. Again, this would require majority of voter approval for general purposes, two-thirds of earmark. But here's probably a really critical consideration, and that is this is only allowed for charter cities. So although it is something you could consider if you got a charter, and it's certainly something a city like Santa Maria, which is a charter city, San Luis Obispo is a charter city, could consider, in your case, you would have to become a charter city before this would even become an option for you to consider. Admissions tax, the long story, two-thirds voter approval. In this case, the voters is weighted by how much acreage you have in the Mello Roos district. Technically, it could be levied against existing development. Requires two-thirds voter approval to do it. I am unaware of any examples of a Mello Roos district that was formed to take care of existing development, partly because it's a very complicated financing mechanism, and if you could get two-thirds voter approval, virtually everything I showed you would be a much more viable way of raising revenues if you're going to meet that two-thirds voter threshold than this one. Very complicated to put together. Where it is primarily used is for new development. And if you had a major new area going in that had new parks, new street lights, new fire station, you might form a Mello Roos district to pay for those services to that new development. And the rationale is it still typically requires two-thirds voter approval. Unless there are less than 12 registered voters, then that could be approved by the council with the concurrence of the property owners. And again, that's why this is really more typically a revenue source that you find associated with large new developments. There are a handful of Mello Roos districts in the county. Paso Robles has a Mello Roos district under formation, I believe. Morro Bay has a special has a Mello Roos district in place for the Cloisters development. But again, it's commonly used source throughout California. But really its main use is servicing significant new service demands by new development. Higher cost recovery. Certainly there are a number of areas where the city can assess fees. Again, revenue cost specialist back in 2002 did a comprehensive analysis, and the council adopted virtually all of those recommendations with two noticeable exceptions. You did not adopt 100% cost recovery for planning fees, and you did not adopt fees for fire engine company inspections. If you had, that would potentially be about another $200,000 a year based on the analysis done by RCS. That is something that could be done with council approval. Franchise fees. City levies several of these for cable TV, gasoline, electrics, trash. And again, the underlying purpose of those franchise fees is for the use of the city's right-of-way, which has significant economic value, and it's the same as charging for the use of any other city facility. And probably the second key thing is the impact on city streets. There's probably nothing that shortens the street life of your pavement more than street cuts by utility companies and trash trucks that are going up and down your streets every day. Those two things have significant impacts on your street system, and that is your responsibility. Now, in the case of electric and gas, your ability to set franchise fees is totally regulated and preempted by the state of California. In terms of cable franchise fees, that's totally preempted and regulated by the federal government, and they've said you can't have a rate that's more than 5%. About the only area where you have flexibility in franchise fees is on your own water and sewer systems. Again, to the degree that gas and electric pay you 2% a year of their gross revenues because of their impact and use of right-of-ways, you could take the same approach for your own water and sewer utilities. And basically, based on the analysis we've done, each 1% franchise fee you would levy on your own utilities would generate about $35,000 annually. And again, you do have flexibility with trash franchise fees. You are the only city in the county that is not at 10%. If you were to go to that countywide standard from 6 to 10%, that would be worth $50,000 a year. And out of all of the revenue options we took a look at, cost recovery and franchise fees are really the only ones where the council has control over that. And if you look at the dollar potentials there, they're not significant compared to the other items. I think a question that emerges is, what's the impact of rate changes on base revenues? If you raise the rate, isn't that going to have an effect on the underlying rate? If you raise the rate by a certain amount, won't people use less of that, and so the revenues will decline? Fair question, but I think you have to put it in context, and it depends. If you were to increase TOT, for example, to 12%, really that's a 2% rise in room prices. That's a 20% increase in your TOT revenues, but that's a 2% increase in the room rate. What you have to ask yourself is, how much of a decline, if you were going to see it at all, would you get with a 2% rate increase? Maybe you would see a 2% decline. So you'd only get 98% of the revenues that this analysis projects. I'll be the first to tell you, I'm not more than 2% accurate in any of these projections. So I think it is likely to myself to have a modest impact, if any at all. Obviously, the hospitality industry would probably have a different story to tell on that. But you need to keep in mind, although that's a 20% increase in your revenues, that's only a 2% increase in the price of the room. And if we were to look at sales tax option, again, if you set a 0.25% sales tax, that's only a 0.25% increase in the prices. That's a 25% increase in city revenues, but that's only a 0.25% increase in the price. So what does that mean? That means a $30 Gap sweater goes up by 8 cents. Do I think a lot fewer Gap sweaters will get sold if they're 8 cents more? No. As they were otherwise going to have to be, and they had a successful majority measure. Typically, where you want to, the message is, we don't have an immediate problem filling chuck holes, arresting bad guys, putting out fires, and mowing grass. It's really that new library you want, or those storm drain improvements you want to make, or those streets you want to widen and improve, those traffic signals you want to put in place, that new fire station we want to build. That's usually a case where you need to go for the two-thirds voter requirement, because you're asking people to fund a specific thing, and you need to be clear about what that message is. And, in fact, Pismo Beach has been successful with two-thirds voter approval ballot measures in the past. For those cities who have had successful revenue measures, I think they share two things in common. One, they did a lot of work in analyzing, preparing for that election before it was ever placed on the ballot. They did a feasibility assessment, and really that turns out to public opinion research. what do the voters think about city services? What do the voters think about what are compelling issues? What do the voters think would be good revenue to support if they were willing to support a revenue measure? You want to have that research underway because you want to be able to transcend what your neighbor thinks, what you may personally think, for what most likely voters are likely to think. And then after that assessment and they identified which revenue sources would attract the most support, which services had the most compelling story to tell, then that was followed up by a six-month to one-year education program for the city to try and tell that story about why we don't have enough money to maintain streets and how important it is to maintain them, or why we don't have enough money for police officers and why we need to hire more of those. But you want to have a minimum of 6 months to tell that story, preferably a year. And then the second essential component is you could have done a great job of analyzing the feasibility of the project. You could have done a great education program. But once you place on the ballot, there has to be a community-based group that's going to aggressively campaign for the measure. Why? Because within your judgment and discretion of what's appropriate, you can spend city funds on evaluating the feasibility of a measure. You can spend funds educating your community about the programs you provide and deficiencies you have. But once it's a ballot measure, you can't spend any city funds advocating for its passage. No staff time, not one paperclip, not one copy. You can't spend any city resources campaigning for the measure. Now, you certainly can provide information about the measure, but you have to be very careful that you're, in fact, doing that in a very impartial, simply the facts, ma'am, approach, and that it can't be interpreted in any way, shape, or form as advocacy for the measure. And if there isn't a group that will do this, it is unlikely, even if you did good homework before you launched it, it's unlikely it's going to be successful in the final analysis in terms of being successful. In that first phase, if you're interested in a revenue ballot measure, what would you need to do? You would need to do public opinion research and some analysis of that public opinion research to answer questions like, how do likely voters feel about the overall quality of life in Pismo Beach? And here's the key thing. Likely voters. It really doesn't matter what the community at large thinks. It really doesn't matter what registered voters think. It only matters what the people who actually come out on election day and cast their vote think. And there are very sophisticated statistical methods for assessing what likely voters think about these issues. Because, again, you could have overwhelming community support to do a certain measure, but if that's not an evidence on election day, that's not going to matter in terms of your ability to do this. So the first key thing to keep in mind is you want to know what likely voters think about this. And how do they feel about city services and how they feel about city government? If you were to raise more money, are they going to be comfortable in trusting you with that? And those revenue measures that are more successful, if they start with a high level of community trust and a high level of community support for their services, typically do better than those communities that start with low negatives. Because they might want better streets, they might want better libraries, they might want better whatever X is, but they don't trust the city government to deliver that if they were given more funds. What are the most important issues facing the city? Obviously, if you're going to have a campaign, you're going to have a message. You want that message to resonate with the most amount of people possible. And are they willing to pay more to do that? And if they are, how much more are they willing to pay? And what revenue source are they most likely to support? You know, I did an extensive analysis of all these revenue sources for you, and I could tell you professionally what I think is maybe a better resource or another one. But at the end of the day, the revenue source is the best one for you increase, is the one that would attract the most voter support for that increase. What are the most compelling reasons to support a revenue ballot measure? One of the other things you want to test is, what are the compelling reasons for people not to? What are the likely arguments that you're going to have to deal with in a campaign as to why people shouldn't support that? And you want to flesh those out early in this process, too, so that as you begin your public education campaign, if you know there are areas that are softer where people need more information in order to make an informed decision, that could both be why they should do it and what are those arguments that you're likely to face. A two-thirds measure, they had a school measure on the ballot at the exact same time they had a city measure. The school measure was not successful in getting two-thirds vote approval, but the city measure was passed with almost 70% voter approval. So people do have the capacity to be very discerning about what they think is important and what they're willing to pay for and make those differences in their support. But this would be a way of, in the public opinion research, of fleshing out, if there was a measure like this, would this make you more or less likely to vote for a city measure? if you were to go forward with that feasibility analysis, then your next step would be to determine if the results were favorable. And if they were, then you would want to launch a public education campaign, and then you'd want to follow up at the end of that public opinion campaign what happened to public support for this. I mean, the worst thing you'd want to find out is now that people found out more about it, you actually lost support. Hopefully what happens is after you've done an education campaign, mm-hmm. you've raised the support. So when you determine favorable doesn't necessarily mean when you surveyed that we didn't have two-thirds that were willing to support it now. Maybe only had 55%. That can still be favorable. Maybe you can now push those numbers up with an effective public information campaign. But how strong your numbers are starting probably tells you how extensive this public education campaign needs to be. If you start with really high favorables to begin with, everybody knows the streets are bad, everyone's willing to support a certain amount of funding for that, you still have to do a public education campaign, but it may not have to be as aggressive, which you can interpret as expensive, as if you started with strong numbers to begin with. And then again, after that public education program, you would want to then do a follow-up survey to see how have the numbers changed from that baseline survey. And again, you need, from the time that you complete that feasibility analysis, you want from 6 months to 12 months to do this public education campaign. And then obviously after you've done the follow-up survey and it tells you that you do have strong numbers or you don't, then you have a key council decision at that point whether to place it on the ballot or not. Obviously, if you do this follow-up survey and you're trying to get two-thirds voter approval and you're still at 48% of the voters that would be willing to do it, you know, maybe it's not worth trying to put this on the ballot because it's unlikely you could be successful in moving those numbers up. On the other hand, by the time you've gone through this program and you're thinking about a two-thirds measure and you've got 70% of the likely voters saying they would support it, then it's probably a good candidate to go forward. But you want to have those two steps in the process before you place a measure on the ballot. You first want to do a good feasibility analysis to see how hard it will be to have a successful measure. Then you want to launch that public information campaign and then remeasure how are we doing in terms of voter support before you place the measure on the ballot. This is a an options recap. And before I go into this, let me talk a little bit about what this means from timing. If you were interested, and I would say that probably your next two best windows of time for revenue measure are either June 2006, that's a statewide election, that's the gubernatorial primary election, so you would have a good turnout for that. More importantly, you'd be able to share the cost of that with other, with the county, and you could have a relatively inexpensive election at that time. That would certainly, with a two-thirds measure, that would be allowable at any time, so you could piggyback onto that. If you were looking at a majority measure, that would require the council to unanimously agree to put that on a June 2006 measure. But that would be a decision-making factor that you would need to consider, whether June or November. I think one of the advantages of a June election is, I think your chances of competing with a lot of other measures is less likely in June. And if you were interested in June, then the question to ask yourself is, so when do we have to start this process? The short answer is a couple of weeks ago. But if, assuming that you would want at least a six-month period, if you work backwards, if you want a June measure, you're going to have to tell the county that you want to consolidate about 4 months before that. There's an exact date count, but it's around 4 months. So you'd need to be able to, you'd have to be at that decision point of placing it on the ballot by February. If you back up the minimum of 6 months that you'd want for a public information campaign, keeping in mind that a year would be preferable, you're into September or October for you to launch that. Backing up from that again, today is the middle of March. For you to hire the people that you need to have on board, that's realistically going to take you 30 to 60 to 90 days just to get those people on board. Then it's going to take them 60 to 90 days to do the analysis and bring it back. So if you wanted to consider it all and have any chance of success, a June 2006 measure, you would need to start working on this right now, at least in terms of starting the process of hiring somebody who's qualified to help you with this work. And that would be giving you a six-month education program. So even if you were thinking November, that's still not too late to be starting now. That just means you would have that 12-month window that most consultants and advisors would actually prefer that you have. So long story short, in terms of timing, if you're interested in considering, I'm not saying that you're ready to decide to place one on the ballot, but if you have money, depending upon what would most attract the voters, And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about revenue options for the city of Pismo Beach.
Okay, I'm going to see if the council has any questions or comments before I open it to the public. I have one. I'm getting the impression from talking to neighboring cities that there's a lot of them in the county that are going to be going out either for a sales tax. Am I correct in that?
A lot? I don't know. I will tell you the two things I do know. I know you're sort of interested in it because you've invested some research in just getting to this point. San Luis Obispo is absolutely we've just launched that process of doing a feasibility assessment. We just brought on board a public opinion research firm and an education program advisor. We've had one meeting, so we're still in a relatively nascent stage in our analysis. We're probably in this process. If you were to launch something today, we're probably about 60 days ahead of you in that process. And to be frank, we're concerned about are we going to be able to have enough time if we decide to go forward with a successful June program. Again, we're going to take a look at what's best June or November, and the people we're going to be hiring will be smart about that, and they'll be able to give us good advice. But we're thinking that at least now that June is maybe a better window of opportunity for us than November, mostly just because we think there will be a lot of competing measures in November and perhaps less in June, which would allow us to have a clearer message. So I know we're clearly engaged in this process. Now, where are we at in terms of the next steps, in terms of actually placing something on the ballot? We're more than several months away from that. But
and
we hope to have
a sales tax that you're considering?
Pardon?
Is it a sales tax increase that you're considering?
That's probably what we're thinking about. But remember my first advice, the measure I will support for San Luis Obispo is the one the public opinion research says can gain the most support from the voters. Our sense is that's probably a sales tax because a relatively small increase has the ability to generate a significant amount of money. But I think all cities have a different story to tell about what revenue source would be most appropriate and most attractive to their voters. So I can only tell you we're engaged in this process. I know at the city manager level, there are a number of city managers that are interested in some sort of coordinated effort, perhaps. I know Paso Robles is very interested in pursuing this. I know that Morro Bay is interested in pursuing something. The county might be. So I think there are a number of cities who are interested in pursuing this. I can only say that something in June, if very much more time goes by to just consider whether you want to consider doing this, you're going to lose the June 2000 window of opportunity for sure. And you wait too long, you will lose the November 2006, because the reality is from the time you decide this is what you want to do until the time it goes on the measure, you need at least 12 months. 18 months would be preferable.
Okay. I had one question that it pertained to what you were talking about. You said you were approximately 30 to 60 days ahead of San Luis Obispo. So do you have a guesstimate of what the feasibility study would cost?
Oh, yeah. It's going to cost us about $35,000 to do.
$35,000?
And to be honest, $20,000 to $25,000 of that, it depends upon how many registered voters you survey and how long the survey is. The budget that council approved for us in February was $35,000. We might do that. Looks like we might bring that in about $30,000, but it's still going to be in that $30,000 range. The public opinion research will cost you between $20,000 to $25,000, depending upon how many people you survey. 400 is the minimum. You could go up to 600 to get a little higher reliability. I don't think we will probably spend the extra money to get that because it's only going to improve the reliability by about 1%. I'm not sure that it's worth another $5,000 to do that. And how long the survey is. If it's 15 minutes, it's a cheaper process than if it's 20 minutes. In general, the conventional wisdom is you don't want to ask people to be on the phone longer than 15 minutes because they're going to get irritated with you.
And who determines the length of the survey?
The questions that you want to ask and how complicated you want to get into it and how many things you want to ask for. The more focused you are in what you think you're interested in, the shorter the survey can be. The last time we did a survey about 2 years ago, it was about 20 minutes long because we really didn't know exactly what it is we were interested in doing specifically. And so we tried to test a number of things. What do you think about flood protection? What do you think about streets? What do you think about traffic congestion? What do you think about police services? And once you do that in a meaningful way where you ask people to compare this with this against this, it's just going to make the survey longer. If you have a better sense, as we do this time around, of what you're looking for, in our case, we're not looking for additional revenues in order to make a cool city cooler. we're looking for added revenue so that we don't have to make further reductions in service levels than we've already made. So we have a clearer idea of what we want to do, so I think we'll be in that 15-minute time frame. It just depends upon how complex your issues are, what the different things are that you want to test for and ask for. 20 minutes is the conventional wisdom of thinking about as long as you want the survey to be. It's better if you can be about 15 minutes. But and obviously, in terms of cost, you know, if you're surveying 400 people, whether it's a 15-minute survey or 20-minute survey, that makes it need more revenues to do things. We think our story this time is different than it was 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we were not our issues were not how do we protect core service levels and how do we adequately maintain existing infrastructure.
And Mr. Statler, you briefly touched on community-based aggressive campaigning going on. And how do you put the fire out on a small group that would aggressively campaign against sales tax or TOT?
I don't think there is any way that you... I mean, this is a democratic society. If there's a handful of people who are opposed and they want to put a lot of energy into it, I don't think there is anything you can do about that. And quite frankly, there isn't anything you should do about that other than have your own strong group that's going to advocate for it. And make sure that you have an aggressive campaign, because I know this much, if someone is out there campaigning aggressively against you and the fours are silent, it doesn't take much to get 34% of the people to be opposed to what it is that you may want to do. You're going to have a campaign that's aggressive and robust and energetic to get out the story about why the city needs that revenues, and you just have to hope in that marketplace of ideas that your ideas will be successful. And if they're not, that's the democratic process, and that's the way it's supposed to work out. So I think the short answer is you can't do anything about
that. So the key is aggressive.
Yeah.
Being aggressive with it. Okay.
Did you have the other question?
Not this time, Madam Mayor.
It might be two. let's say you pass something, let's say sales tax, and it passes on the ballot. Then how long does it take to begin to reap the reward, so to speak, and how much money does it cost to implement that change?
Well, the cost to implement the change will be extraordinarily modest because the State Board of Equalization will collect it for you along with the regular sales tax. There will be a modest administrative fee for it, but it won't be significant. And probably, you know, within 90 to 180 days after the voters approve it, you can have the revenue, the new item in place. Won't be very difficult to do because the collection mechanism is all in place to do it. The State Board of Equalization just needs to know to assess this higher rate on your behalf than is the case. But you would be able to put it into place pretty quickly. TOT, you'd be able to put into place technically within 30 days after the voters approve it, because this would be your own revenue measure. So most of these could be in place pretty quickly. If you were looking at something more taxable-oriented, that would really depend upon the county cycle. If you had something in place by March of the year, you could have it within the next 3 months in the following fiscal year. If it happens after that, you'd have to wait till the next fiscal year to collect that.
Okay, I guess we lost Rudy. Okay, with that, if we don't have any other questions, I'm going to go to the public. Okay, is there anyone in the public that has questions, comments regarding this item on the agenda?
Well, needless to say, the Chamber's been doing some heavy lifting in the background to get prepared for whenever we're going to get into the next round of discussions. One of the things we came up with, you really need to read Bill's white paper in the back of the revenue study. This thing, I think, has really inspired us being business people. We looked at diversification and sustainability. It's an excellent piece, and it kind of pleads our case of where we're coming from, a lot of us that we've been talking about this in the background. One of the things we did find that would really help out is this little table right here. This little table is from CaliforniaCityFinance.com, and what it is, we have it. You don't have it anyplace. The Chamber has it. We want to distribute it to you if you find it usable. But what it has is almost everything that Bill's talked about, all of the different categories for revenue increase. It shows economic risk and political risk in sustainability, vulnerability, and volatility. So it's really interesting because we just talked about sales tax. So what it says about sales tax is medium volatility, medium sustainability, and high political risk. Okay. Now, on the TOT, it says high volatility, medium sustainability, and low political risk. So obviously, by looking at this, you would say, well, let's hang our hat on TOT. But another thing, too, we found out in our studies, because we're business people, we get the new district sales tax form from the State Board of Equalization. 17 cities passed district sales tax increases this year. So we got a new list. I gave it to Randy. In fact, he saw that. And as those people in those districts, as of a certain date, has to start reporting the new sales tax. So that's how that works. One of the things we're concerned about is on his slide 35, where he showed basically the possible revenue gains. This has always been a big bone of contention with us, the TOT possibilities. Now, we've read ballot measures from other people that want to raise TOT, and it always says, will increase 1%, will increase 10%. That's not true. You know, that's feasible theoretically, but it's not true, and it doesn't really happen. So, the economics of the time, but it took us many years to realize a 43% gain in that. That's just always the let's hang it on the voters. Let's hang it on the voters. Voters, let's not vote for anything, that's going to hang it on us. Let's put it on the back of the visitors. They say, okay, for every 1%, we'll get 10%. But then after the fact, you can just go down and say, okay, this is when Napa raised it. They should have seen a 20% gain. Where is that 20% gain? It didn't come about. They do an increase, but maybe their increase prior to that was 5%. So that means a 20% increase on top would be a 25% increase, because the 5 that they're getting historically plus that. We're just saying that, watch that. We got to really say, hey, what are we going to do here, and how is it going to work out, and are we really going to get the money out of it? Right now it seems like the best thing going right now is sales tax, because it's pretty solid. It's not going to have too bad of an effect on anybody that we can see. Let me see what else I've got here for you. We've got basically how the different revenue measures have gone all the way back to 2002, so you can see that, what's been successful, what's not been successful. If you want to try something really tough, go to utility users tax. It's really, what it says here on utility user tax: medium volatility, high sustainability, and medium vulnerability to political risk. But, I mean, that's the voters taxing themselves for a consumption tax, and it really has to leave a bad taste in the voters' mouth to tax themselves. But once again, Reed Bill's paper on diversification and sustainability, I wouldn't want to put all our eggs in TOT's basket thinking it's going to do it, and then it lets us down the road. That's our best knowledge right now. So we've got some papers, we've got some studies that we can pass out when it's time to go into the next round of, what are you guys going to decide? When are you going to say, hey, I want to hang our hats on this or that? And the last thing I want to do is ask George once again, how are we doing, George, in optimizing TOT with getting away from the 30-day little lapse of, that's money that we can get right now that we're leaving on the table. It's been there every day for many years now, and I'm sure George has got an answer of how that's going. Remember, you don't pay TOT if you stay in a hotel over 30 days.
Gotcha. I have one question of you. CaliforniaCity.com. Tell me what kind of an organization
CaliforniaCityFinance.com.
What kind of?
I guess that's where people like George hang out and Bill. But it's got.
Can
lots
anybody
of
tell me anything about it? Please, ahead, Mr. Stout.
That is a highly credible source. That is a website maintained by Michael Coleman, who's an advisor and consultant to the League of California Cities. So, the speaker indicated, I use that website frequently for information about what is the impact of ELF cuts, what's the impact of triple flip. So that is a very credible website source. Michael Coleman's a very smart, capable person that the League of California Cities uses for its financial advice in terms of what the impact of legislation would be and the types of things to support. So I do think that's the information there is credible.
Okay. When the TOT was raised in 93, that was kind of an era. There was the economy kind of
for whatever it's worth, in San Luis Obispo's
case, really not
case,
reap the benefits that we thought.
I can't speak to all the other cities in California. I can speak that when San Luis Obispo raised our rate from 6% to 10%, we saw in the following year exactly the kind of increase we expected to see. You wouldn't have seen that in the first fiscal year because we didn't implement it until October. So you would have only have seen 75% of the impact, and less, because as with you, our best tourist months are in the summer. And so to the degree that we didn't implement that tax until October, First off, we only had it in place for 75% of the year, and we had it in place against some of our lowest months. But when we had a full year to compare apples to apples, it absolutely gave us exactly the kind of added revenue that we had predicted.
Okay, thank you. Rudy, you stepped out when we asked if the council had any questions.
No, I didn't have any questions.
Okay, is there anything in response
I did want to make one comment, though. You're going to have you mentioned that you're going to have an awful lot of issues on the November ballot, by the way. The state's going to put a ton of them on. So I would not suggest that we even think about putting anything on in November.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the public that would like to speak on this item?
Don Day, 101 Park Place, Mayor. Madam Mayor, members of the council. This may have already been addressed. Was that my 3-minute clock?
That's it. It's over.
Now, I may have missed this. I got here a little late, and I'll apologize. But I would like to know about the unallocated fund differential between what we have now and what we had a couple of years ago. And I think without some clarification and better understanding from some of us in the public, some of us would have a hard time finding a compelling need for the increases without a justification as to where this unallocated funds has gone in the past, because we contemplate laying off staff in order to just maintain a lesser level, let alone an equal level. So I guess my point is that I'm concerned about the unallocated funds and why we no longer have those funds available in order to justify a compelling need for these increases. Thank you.
Okay. George, do you want to respond to that question? And then I just have one comment. If you look at this chart, this says just to maintain the things that we have now, there's a gap, which we're not doing now.
And I believe if you look at those numbers are somewhere in the neighborhood of $800,000 a year, thereabouts. And if I'm not mistaken, and if this is from memory, which fails me very often frequently, we had unallocated funds in excess of $500,000 a year not too long ago, and approaching $1 million 1 year. Thank you.
Okay, do you want to talk about the unallocated?
Yes, if I might.
Quickly, sure.
Sure.
Because we have a 6:30 closed session, so we're going to have to adjourn and then come back. And so I was afraid of... No, I'm kidding. I'm teasing. But we probably would like at least a 2-minute break. So if you can cover this quickly for us, it would be good.
Very quick. If I might pass something up. And we just completed a table on something that I think relates to this. If I might give it to you.
Okay. Do you want to define unallocated funds for us to begin with?
I think what Don is talking about is, in effect, the net revenues at the end of the year. We have, let's say at the beginning of the year, let's look at the year specifically out here. Back in fiscal 2000, we budgeted for... Thank you, Marty. Thank you. Can you hear me now? We budgeted for a little over $8.1 million of revenue. And I'm going to jump on you here a little bit. We budgeted for $9.2 million in expenditures, and the budget was that we'd actually have a negative net revenue for that year, negative $1 million. In reality, revenues came in about almost $1 million higher. You see that $953,000. Expenditures were about $1 million lower, $1,146,000. And the actual net revenues, therefore, the 9.1 minus the 8.1 equals almost $1 million, and so unallocated money, $2 million that year. Okay, the next year following the same thing is another about $2.3 million, and the
George,
year.
Sorry, I can't find 9.1.
Did I say 9.1?
Yeah.
This right here, 9.1.
The 9.1 in
actual revenue.
9.1 actual revenue.
Oh,
9.1
fiscal year.
Right.
Thank you. Okay,
2000.
Gotcha.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Gotcha.
And the actual expenditures, actual 8.1, gotcha. And therefore the actual net revenue was a plus million almost instead of a minus million.
Okay, now, so this might have been the case a few years in a row, but isn't that one of the ways that we were able to pay for downtown?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
In fact, what happened was these monies, as I've understood it, got rolled forward into some capital projects, such as downtown. And so, whereas there were large unallocated funds, over in back in 2000, 2001, over 2 million, came down to 1 million in 02, and then the last couple of years they have been essentially like none.
So, in the last couple of years, there hasn't been any unallocated funds.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Does that help everybody? Any questions on that?
And on that, by the way, part of that is because they rolled forward some more money for capital projects. More capital projects, and so your expenditures went up.
Okay, is there anyone else in the public? We are supposed to be scheduled for a closed session at 6:30. The person has not arrived as of yet, so we could continue for a short period of time. I'll ask the council what they want to do. I think we should probably take a short break after we finish with this item, at least, to give us that opportunity.
Have we heard from
him? He's not here yet.
But we haven't heard from him.
I just checked a minute ago. He's not here yet.
Yeah. So we could just, let's at least try to finish this item, take a quick break and see where we're at then.
Okay.
And then we can start
that's
another
fine.
Item if we want to.
I think that's
would
great.
Would everybody agree to that?
Sure.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the public that would like to address this item? Okay. Seeing none, then we will take a 5-minute break. Okay.
Too long?